couple weeks ago. We are in the 19th chapter of Judges. I hope you've enjoyed. It's hard to, some of this stuff is hard to say you enjoyed the book of Judges, but we're going to go into another section here, which is quite interesting. And what I want you to think about over the next few weeks as we close out the book of Judges, and I want you to see how doing what's wrong compounds upon itself. And it leads to something, you know, that you sin will always lead you in a place that you don't want to go, and probably further than you ever think it would take you. And I think if we look at some of the messages of the book of Judges as a whole, that's true. Certainly Samson's life is true of that. You know, it took him further than he'd want to go, and it cost him more than he was willing to pay. But I think that's true as we close out this book. He's the writer here. Again, I believe to be Samuel, is trying to give us information about what it was like when the people had no king and no leadership. And I would say certainly that includes the matter of spiritual leadership and people running loose and seeking their own form of justice and inciting others to join them in their quest for their style of justice and stuff. And before long, you have consequences of these actions and reactions that are just devastating and can even be generational. I think it's part of why Paul in the New Testament tells us this very wonderful verse where he says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Don't carry it over, because if you carry it over, what's going to happen? It will fester and it will develop to be more than it needs to be. So, with that in mind, let's look at the 19th chapter and the story that is given here. And it's quite an interesting story, but it's kind of a sad, it is certainly a sad story at the same time. So let's look at it. It says, it came to pass in those days there was no king in Israel, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite sojourning in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So the mountains of Ephraim, this region right in here, would run up in here, okay? Here you have Jerusalem. 5 miles outside of Jerusalem, you have the small community called Bethlehem. Okay, and down here in this region is where that's the same region that they'll get their first king from. Okay, and from the same tribe. The first king of Israel was not from the tribe of Judah, but was from the tribe of Benjamin. His name was Saul. Okay, so that's the area, and he takes for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now, the matter of the concubine. It's something foreign to us. But can we agree that the Bible clearly teaches in the Old Testament where that men had more than one wife or concubine? And depending on how you define this word concubine, you could have something very similar to Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. Okay, that the woman was more of a possession, but at the same time, how do I want to say it?
Secondary wife.
A secondary wife. That's a good way to put it. Okay, or secondary, third, fourth, fifth, you know, depending on who the individual is. So we deal with this matter of what's called polygamy. All right? And I know some Bible teachers who say the Bible does not teach polygamy, but it teaches polygyny. And I say, well, you're just parsing words now. And I say, polygamy means that you can have more than one spouse. Polygyny means that a man can have more than one spouse. And there's a movement in some churches today of continued polygyny. So what they say is, all you have to do is read the Bible and you'll see that it was practiced. And we would all agree about that, would we? My challenge to them is this: where in the scripture is it ever taught to be allowed? I don't care who you're talking about. Go all the way back to Abraham. I want to go back further than that. Go back to Adam. What did he say? The two shall become what? One. When man begins to put his own twists on things like that, then you begin to have things happen that are not in God's will, but they certainly do happen. So you have multiple marriages, even from some of our quote biblical heroes. David had more than one wife. Abraham had more than one wife. Solomon certainly had. I don't even know how he got called the wisest man that ever lived, but you know, you're talking about 1,000. So this was the practice. By the way, if you go over there today, there's still a group of people, the Bedouins, who still practice this. Actually, the Islamic religion allows for this. They're allowed to have 4. I don't know where they get the number 4. That's what they're allowed to have. And in the Bedouin group, which is a specific group of people, they don't claim any nationality. I don't know if you knew that. The Bedouins don't claim, and they don't recognize any borders. Bedouins will go from Israel into Jordan, down to Saudi Arabia, and they're on their camels, and they're living like they did thousands of years ago. And they do have a little bit of help with water, because water trucks still come in and help them out and stuff like that. But they just live, you know, like that, and they're allowed to have up to 4 wives according to their religious practices. The only thing that's required is that the man has to provide the woman a tent.
Oh,
yeah. Let me tell you, that's the best you get. Because if you go over there and you hang around with the Bedouin, and they'll let us hang out with them and stuff. They'll talk to you and stuff. But one person you will never see in a Bedouin camp is the Bedouin's wife. Who you will see is if he has daughters and stuff, the daughters will take care of your needs and stuff. They'll cook for you. They'll give you something to drink and stuff like that. The wife stays in the tent when there are foreigners around. But the men do no work. None. They don't tend the sheep. The wife, until there's children, his wives take care of the sheep. When she's with child, all the way up until childbirth, she's tending the sheep. When she has a child, that child is put on her back and she's tending the sheep. What does he do all day? He sits outside the tent smoking his cigarettes and talking to the other Bedouin men.
We can learn from that.
Yeah. Okay. And when it's time, and they move with the water, and they move with the grass that feed their sheep and goat. Okay. And so when it's time to move on, he grunts. I think that's how he does it. He grunts. She folds up the tent. She loads up the tent. He gets up, gets on his camel, and they move to the next site. Along with all the sheep and stuff like that. And then when they get there, she unloads the tent, she sets up the tent, you know. And the Bedouin's tent is the same way it was for thousands of years. It's got 3 areas. It has the marriage chamber area, it has the guest area, and it has the animal area. And we were told when we were over there, they think them animals, if you think it's bad they have their animals in there, they think them animals smell better than you do. So.
But she also kills the sheep to prepare the food.
The ladies prepare everything. Yes, they do everything. The guy does. I'm telling you, he does nothing. Oh, they may have a council meeting type thing, and you know he'll spread his wings out there and be the man.
Hey, somebody has to be the chief.
Yeah. Well, of course. Yeah. So. But here's what I want you to understand. When we read the Scripture is brutally honest. But please, there are those who assume that because the Bible doesn't say every time it talks about a concubine or multiple wives, it doesn't condemn it, that somehow the silence on the matter is condoning it. The Bible never teaches, ever, multiple wives as being proper before God. It does recognize that that they did. Frank.
Some of them get in trouble, like Schwarzenegger and our congressman. Though.
Yes.
Like who?
Schwarzenegger, when he was his housemaid and our congressman got booted out.
Well, you know what? You say we wouldn't get in trouble if they did that, but how many stories we know in the Bible where even though it was legitimate in that society, they still trouble upon trouble because there was one more than one woman in the home.
It even says too many women in the kitchen spoils the broth.
Yeah, where is that?
I can show you some.
Okay, so anyways, this guy was a Levite, which tells you what tribe he was from. Okay, and remember the Levites did not have a specific area; they were given cities in each of the 12 regions that the tribes were put in. This guy's area clearly was up in the hills of Ephraim, but he took for himself a concubine, which probably would indicate that he had a primary wife, and we don't know how many other concubines we have. But once you took the concubine, again, you have this system where it's not so much of you see her, you fall in love, and you do all these kind of things. You date for a while, you go to the movies on your camels and stuff like that, and you say, "I'd like to marry you." Sometimes it's just as much as saying, "You know what? I'm going to buy your daughter." It sounds bad.
It does.
But that's what it is. I'll give you so many camels.
It's just
okay.
It's just lunch.
Yeah, it's just lying. Yeah, okay. So, and that's what it is. And they were seen. The word that's used there for a lot of this is chattel, because they were actually just it was an agreement between two men for one man's daughter. And usually it was what we would categorize as a teenage girl, and the man was usually older in age and stuff. Because he was able to sustain. I mean, one of the things the father would say is, "You will give me a dowry. You will pay the price. You will do all of this. You'll make sure, but you will take care of my daughter. You'll be able to take care of her." Okay? So, verse 2 now says, "But his concubine played the harlot." So now we have something else going on here. She belonged to him, according to the culture and everything. And what does she do? She plays the harlot. And we understand that terminology, that she went and she had relationships with other men other than this man. So she played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there 4 whole months. Now, when I read that, what I understand is that the father knows what's going on. You don't just, show up at home and don't have any idea. And so we don't have all the details about the father. I mean, he could be the kind of guy, says she played the harlot, he could be the kind of guy that is getting a dowry for her from several different guys at the same time. Who knows? As you look at the picture here, I mean, he seems to allow her to come back and everything, and to live with him. Yeah.
Is this the same Levite that was with Micah?
No.
Okay. No.
But another Levite, not where he's supposed to be, not instructing the people about God. It just not named again like the other Levite wasn't until near the end. Just representative of what was going on in Israel, right down to the religious.
And what this tells you is that although this is one occasion, this explodes, as we're going to look at it in the next couple of weeks. This just explodes into from a no-name Levite and his concubine explodes into affecting the whole nation. And you would say, well, who's this guy? Well, I guess the point is that sin is greater than the notoriety of even the people who are involved in it. The consequences are. And sometimes we think that we can sin without there being any consequence or it affecting anybody else. But the truth is, there's always consequences with sin, and sin always affects more people than we have any idea about.
Absolutely.
And the Bible continually tries to help us understand that we need to take sin seriously. Because it is devastating. It kills. All right? So, verse 3 says, "Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her." Anybody else have another word there?
Tenderly.
Okay.
Persuade her.
And my little footnote says to speak to her heart. Okay. Speak kindly to her and bring her back. having his servants and a couple donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the father young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Okay. Something is goofy here. Okay. She didn't become a concubine on her own. There's already been a deal done here. I think this Levite also knows that something's going on too, because what does he come with? He comes not only by himself, but with servants and with donkeys. Which there's an inference there that he came with items to woo her, to win her heart, to get her back. And she's already been at her father's house for 4 months, and I don't know that he doesn't think that, well, you know what, her father's taking her back, I'm going to have to do this all over again type thing in order to get her. And that's what seems to be inferred here. And then the father reaction is almost like he doesn't know him. I never met this guy before type thing. You know, it's kind of like buying a lemon and going back to the used car lot again, and the guy looks at you, well, you look vaguely familiar. Someone was here with two eyes like you have and they had hair on their head like you do, but I don't recall the name. Okay? It's the type of inference that is there. So he was glad to meet him and said, now his father-in-law, interesting. I'm glad to meet you, but I'm your father-in-law. Okay? Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him. And he stayed with him 3 days, and they ate and they drank and lodged together. Now, just so you know, again, there's something to the 3-day thing. Did anybody ever see Lawrence of Arabia? Bedouins are involved in Lawrence of Arabia. Okay. To this day, the Bedouins have a societal standard. Okay, and that is, if someone is traveling and stuff through that desert, because people could die in the desert, that you are to allow them to stay in your home, to drink your water, to eat your food for 3 days. After the third day, they better be gone. Matter of fact, people have been killed because after the third day, it becomes stealing their water. And stealing water in the desert is a capital offense. Okay? So the significance of the 3 days is just that's the way that they, it's the hospitality, it was the culture, it's the custom, and it's a custom, it's interesting, it's still going on today, it's a custom that's thousands of years old. So it would not have been uncommon for you say you stay with us for a while, and that while would be that 3-day period. But what would have been uncommon is for someone to be asked to stay longer than that. And so here we have this father-in-law, this lady's dad, who's up to something. Which every fiber of my being tells me that he's been playing a role in her harlotry. That he's been playing a role in the manipulation of men using her for that purpose. Okay, I don't think it was the first time she went off with somebody and came back. The runaway bride, the runaway the runaway concubine. We could do a movie on that. Okay, so she comes back, and what's he do? What's he do? He sells her again. Okay, and he's got a scheme going here. Is it right? Of course not. It's another one of those indicators. It's another one of those indicators of where these people were. This is a Hebrew woman. Okay? This is a woman of the tribe of Benjamin. This whole thing is just messed up. Okay? And there is no consideration for anything godly. There's no consideration for... He's selling her as a piece of property. It's clear. Okay? So, now what we're going to have is his actions are going to affect things. Her actions are going to affect things. This Levite who's at the wrong place at the wrong time, his actions are going to affect things. And you have all these things, again, like we talked about, compounding upon each other until we're going to see, again, in a couple of weeks, it's going to affect the whole nation.
No, Benjamin, you say in 3 days you're out.
Mm-hmm.
They give you water and stuff to, for your
yeah.
journey. What after? No, it's the third morning. You're after the third morning, you're gone. Do they give you water and stuff
yeah.
to go with?
Yeah, they make sure you're okay. They have particular laws, what they call them laws of the desert, that they have to live by in order to survive. All right, so then it came to pass on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way. So they sat down, and the two of them ate and drank together. Then the young man's father said to the man, please be content to stay all night, let your heart be merry. Verse 7, and if you want to put comments in here, feel free. It says, and when the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. Then he rose early on the fifth day to depart, but the young woman's father said, please refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. These are long meals, aren't they? We were kind of educated last night. We went over to a lady's house, her, a new lady in our church, and she was raised in an Italian family and stuff. And she pretty much helped us understand, Teresa and I understand, that eating at an Italian home is not like eating at my home. When I was raised, you know, my dad said, you sit down, you shut up, you eat, you finish, you get up, and you leave. That's my growing up. That's the wonder of eating at the Pierce's house growing up. But what she said, eating is an all day thing. It's an event, you know. And they're certainly making this an event here. I mean, I can grab a piece of toast and grab a swig of water and be on my camel and out of there at any time. So there's more going on here. Again, manipulation. For what purpose? Well, I don't know. And I'm open to any suggestions that you might have on this, except it seems like he's delaying. The father-in-law is delaying to gain some sort of advantage that I don't know that he ever gains, but he's going to run it on out. Because remember, I believe he's involved in this with his daughter, and he's gotten rich off of her. And I'm not sure that what has happened in the past is that has there been anybody that's really come after like this Levite has come after. But remember, when he came, he had two donkeys full of whatever he brought. All right.
He's buying time because he's not quite sure what he wants to do yet. You're right, though. He does not want to let her go again because she's the income. You got to tell me that they're not.
Right.
Swigging down a little wine here every night to keep this Levi drunk so he doesn't know what's going on. I mean, that's what's going on here.
Yeah.
What he hopes to accomplish, we're not told. Scripture won't tell us that. But obviously the father-in-law has a plan, and he needs to detain this Levi for whatever he's going to come up with. But
was that the beginning of enabling?
Well, no, it is really just manipulation because he... He's about to see the cash cow leave. So, all right, verse 9. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow go your way early so that you may get home. He's just blowing smoke. I don't know how else to say it. It makes it sound good. Okay, he's not concerned about this guy at all. Okay. Do you know when people are doing that to you? I hope you do. Don't be gullible. Okay, have some discernment. But by the way, people will do that if you'll let them. In almost every arena of life, people will do that if you let them. It's a shame that you have to. I'm a natural born skeptic, so. I'm always looking for why someone's telling me something. Except for my wife. I just believe her completely. Her and Rick. That's the two I believe completely. All right. Verse 10. But the man was not willing to spend that night. He had had enough of this. Okay. Maybe finally said, you know, I got your game. I know what you're doing here. Okay? I know what you're about. And so it says, he rose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus. Jebus, that's where you get, you've probably heard of the group called the Jebusites. Jebusites. Okay? They were the ones that actually, at this time, occupied Jerusalem. Okay? So again, Old City Jerusalem and Old City Bethlehem are approximately 5 miles apart. Okay? Today, they're connected. I mean, the cities, because you have the modern cities that have grown together and stuff, and actually they're connected and separated by a big wall, because Bethlehem is occupied by the Palestinians. Okay? And Jerusalem is occupied. I mean, there's Muslims there, but it belongs to Israel right now. And will continue, I believe. But Bethlehem belongs to the Palestinians. And you, Bethlehem, by the way, for many years was the most Christian community in all the Middle East. There were more Christian Arabs that lived in Bethlehem than any other place in the Middle East. Now, what we found out this last time we went there, I think it's about 80% Islamic now and 20% Christian. So when we go into Bethlehem, we actually go to the stores that are owned by the Christian Arabs and we support them. You know, when we buy the trinkets and stuff, we support them, because they're really where they used to be. I mean, it used to be the opposite. That's what he told us. It used to be the opposite. It was 80%. It used to be like 80% Christian and 20% Muslim, Arabs, Palestinian Arabs. And he said it has completely changed. So the Christian Arabs are under persecution there. By the way, they're under persecution also down in Egypt too. So it's not an easy place. There are Christian Arabs. I mean, sometimes people say, well, all Arabs are Islamic. They're not. There are born-again Christian Arabs. The guy who guided us in Egypt was a born-again Christian. He went with the Presbyterian Church over there in Egypt. But you have the Coptic Church over there in Egypt. You also have a large Presbyterian group. But they're becoming quickly the minority. And they are persecuted. Okay, they're pretty much seen as non-people. Saudi Arabia is a whole other matter. Saudi Arabia, if you are a Saudi Arabian citizen, you can be killed for being anything other than Islamic. Okay? So, anyways, I just tell you that to give you a background where they are now. But just, you know, if you think about praying for them, we have Christian brothers and sisters that live in Bethlehem that are coming under a lot of pressure from the Islamic growth there. So keep them in prayer. But for this purpose, so he leaves in the evening and he goes approximately 5 miles. So he's outside the city, the old city of, we call Jerusalem, but at this time it was called Jebus. Okay? And it wasn't a good place for... It didn't have a great reputation, let's put it that way. Okay, the Jebusites were not... Now, Doug, help me. From what I understand, the Jebusites were not Jews. They were not Israelis. No. Okay, so they were part of the groups that were left in the land when they came in. And when you think of Jerusalem now, please don't think of Jerusalem then as you think about Jerusalem now. We're talking about a little podunk place. Okay. Even if you go into Old City Jerusalem, which represents the time that Jesus was there and stuff, compared to New City, I mean, the size of modern Jerusalem, it's a very small place. You go into the walls of the old city. The walls of the old city actually set within the perimeter of the new city. Okay.
But even as Jerusalem began to enlarge and grow from this period of time, the Jebusites held it. Jebusites held Jerusalem right until the time David finally rooted them out of there. They were strong.
Yeah.
But you're right, timing is everything. But this Levite's not exactly a rocket scientist. Why does he... I mean, I can understand his frustration once he gets out of there, but at least wait till the morning.
Right. So with him there were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. Okay, and the servant, from what I understand, the servant is with him also. Verse 11. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come, please, let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." But his master said to him, We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not the children of Israel. We will go to Gibeah. Or how would you say it? That's probably as close as I'm going to get, Gibeah. All right, so here's the assumption. Okay? The assumption that he makes is that if we stay among our own people, we'll be okay. Okay? Should be that way. But what we're going to see in this story, that it's not that way. Because go back to the first part of chapter 19. What does he say? There was no king in the land. There was no leadership. There was no law in the land. There was no administration of law. We go back to the statement we hear so many times in this one book, and every man did what was right in their own eyes. And so many times we just associate that with spiritual things, but it's. I think the whole portion of as he closes out the book of Judges is to let us know it. Certainly, it's spiritual, but also it's some of the most horrific illegal activities, also corrupt illegal activities, because there's nobody there. You know, people have cast off all restraint. You know, they have no sense of right or wrong, and you know, if you think about it today. It shouldn't be that the people who have a strong sense of morality and right or wrong have to fear the law. Shouldn't be. If the law is right, the law is not corrupt. Who should have to fear the law? Well, the ones who would do wrong. Okay. The law is really, the law couldn't. There's no way that the law even today could regulate everything everybody does. You understand? We're mostly self-regulated. There are things you could probably get away with for a period of time. But hopefully there's something in you and I that says, that's wrong. Okay? These people had lost that. And it's not even a matter that there's a small amount of law that could direct their past. They don't have anything. And they've cast off everything. And each man determines what he wants to do. And basically it's whatever he can get away with is what he's going to do.
Do you think that phrase then throughout this area that we're reading about, that the author continues to use, there was no king in Israel. Obviously, there was no king in Israel. We didn't have kings yet. Do you think he is referring to the fact that the people have fallen away from the king God?
I certainly think it would be carried to the thing to the sense of they have no sense of anybody is an authority. And before this time, it would have to be God would be their ultimate authority. They had the word. They had their Levites, but look at the Levite.
It's not
just a coincidence that the one that Samuel, I think that Samuel wants to tell us about this incident. There were so many incidents going on that he chooses the Levite because it speaks of both things here. It speaks of the societal condition that everybody did what they want, but it also speaks of the spiritual condition because those men who should be the spiritual leaders throughout the whole land had no sense of what's right any longer. And by the way, we see this pattern when the kings of Israel started turning away from God and doing wrong. Okay, we see this pattern. The kings go, the priests go, the people go. And by the way, the only voices in that whole time, as we've studied the Old Testament, when the elders went, or judges went, and then the people went, the only voice that God had was that He would raise up a prophet. Now, how was a prophet received?
Not well.
Okay, they killed them all. I mean, that was Jesus' word. Which of God's prophets did you not kill? Did your fathers not kill? They rejected, you know, because the people did not want to hear what the prophet had to say. And I'm telling you, the prophet did not come and give messages of you know, how to win friends and influence people. He wasn't there so everybody felt good about themselves when they walked out. He was there to tell them the truth at a great cost to them. Personal. Some of the things God had these prophets do, I'm thinking, my goodness. I mean, we have. I'm reading in Isaiah. God had Isaiah walk around naked for a while. You know? God had, was it Ezekiel? He had to lay on one side for a while, and he had to lay on the other side for a while. And God had Hosea marry a prostitute. You know?
No, I was just thinking about the prophets of old, just like you're talking about. Jeremiah is a good example. Weeping prophet.
What a heart he had for God and God's people, you know. And yet sometimes he's treated, even by some scholars today, as being, well, I won't say it, not quite all that good. I'm not saying I'm bad, but he just sort of, Jeremiah had issues. And I think it's a wrong thing to say Jeremiah had issues. You have Jeremiah who had a heart for God and was called to do something in a very terrible time. Sometimes we evaluate these guys where we are. And we've got to be careful of that. Okay, these prophets, it cost them everything to stand up and say the things that they said. Everything. You know, Elijah? What did Ahab have to say about Elijah? Did Ahab like Elijah? Okay, here you come again. What bad news you got for me now? And then someone says, well, why don't we ask the prophet? And what did he say? He said, I'm not going to ask the prophet anything. Every time you ask him something, he's got bad news. Yeah. Okay, so we'll go on to Gebeth. Now, I don't know if Gebeth is on here. No, it's not. It would be in this area, but it's not there.
But Pastor,
it is a Jewish community. What? Yes.
But Pastor, would it be any different today if Elijah or Jeremiah or anything was here today telling what they were? God told him to say across the whole, I'm talking about across the whole gamut of people, it wouldn't be any different.
No, it wouldn't. Man's heart is away from God. Mm-hmm. Man's heart is always inclined away from God. Man's heart is only touched and moved toward God because the Holy Spirit does that. Right. Okay? And again, God reminded Elijah, the great prophet, although he felt like he was alone. And I can certainly understand why he felt like he was alone. Can't you? But God took time to say, Elijah, you're not alone. There are 7,000 who are mine. God always has a remnant. But the majority will never listen. The majority will never listen. I think it's incredible. We were talking about this when we were doing Isaiah, and we're talking about my little timeline here that I put up. We talk about the millennium and stuff. You have perfect government for 1,000 years. You have peace. You have no poverty. You have what some would even describe as health, like the world has never seen before. All these things for 1,000 years. You have perfect government where you have Jesus ruling and reigning on this earth. Yet the Bible says at the end of that, Satan will be loosed and he will lead the nations once again to go up against Christ. He will deceive them. You've got to be really deceived to believe they can do what they think they're going to do. You know. Because it's not society. It's not environment. Those things do have impacts on us. I agree with that. But they don't make us right. And ultimately they don't make us wrong. You know, God does that. All right, so verse 13. So he said to his servant, come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gebeth of Ramah. And they passed by and went by their way, and a sun went down on them near Gebeth, which belongs to Benjamin. So same region, same area. It is a tribe of Benjamin. It's a community of the tribe of Benjamin. They turned aside there to go in to a lodge in Gebeth, and when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city. I read that wrong, because if you take it the way I read it, you think that there's an Econo Lodge or something in this community. Okay? But there isn't. They didn't have hotels, Motel 6s and stuff like that. what happened is you would get to the community at a certain time and you would go to the square just like he did here, and you would hope that there would be someone in the community that would open their home to you, and that you would go in, you could lodge with them for the night before you moved on. Okay? And if you were a good person, you would come with things where you wouldn't be a burden to the people that open their home and stuff. But what you would hope is that someone would meet you there in the square and offer you a place to stay. So that's what he did. They're looking for a place to lodge there. And he went in and he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take him into his house to spend the night. That's inhospitable. Okay, it's a people that's looking to their own selves rather than to the needs of others. Another indicator of where they are spiritually. Okay, verse 16. Just then, an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. So he's actually not a Benjaminite. Okay, but he apparently lives in this community. Okay, so he's come in, and he was sojourning in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjaminite, which simply means he wasn't just traveling through, but he wasn't a permanent resident of this tribe. Okay, but he was living among them. Everybody get the picture there? Right? So, verse 17, and when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" Who should have done that? I mean, if you just think about it, who should have done it? Should it not have been someone of that community, someone of that tribe, someone, you know, a Benjaminite, to take care of the needs of this person that was passing through? So he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I am going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house." Okay? "Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for myself, for your maidservant, and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything." So he's again indicating he don't want to be a burden to anybody. He just wants a roof over his head for the night. But nobody would offer him that. And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." This is very similar to another story in the New Testament. Anybody, you heard the parable Jesus gave of the Good Samaritan? When you have the Jewish man who is beaten and robbed and stuff, and you have his Jewish brethren who walk past him and have nothing to do with him, but the foreigner meets his needs, takes care of him, takes him to a place where he can get help, and then pays for his help, and then tells the people who are going to help him, "And if it costs any more than this, you let me know and I'll take care of that too." And here we have again a foreigner, as it were, taking care of this other foreigner's need, and he says, "And I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to do what I should do." Okay? So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and he washed their feet and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Okay? Customs. Washing the feet, preparing so that they can relax for the evening. All right? So everything sounds good. Everything sounds wonderful. But something is about to happen, which may answer the question why no one offered him a place to stay in the first place. Because there were some intentions of the men of the city. But they wait till the darkness. They wait till the night to, and again, reflect what Jesus says. It says those who do their evil deeds at night, in the darkness. Because even the most evil person somehow knows that what they're doing is not right and decent. Okay? That's why they do it in the darkness. They don't want to be seen. Well, if it's okay, if it's all right, why would you care if someone saw you? Why would you try to hide it? Okay? So, there is something within us. And, you know, there are those who talk about total depravity in the sense that man has no sense of right or wrong apart from God. And I think there's something God has put in every human being that we do have a sense of right or wrong. Now that sense can be certainly become dull over time as we go off into sin and stuff. But still, you have men trying to hide and do things at night that they wouldn't do in the daytime. And by the way, the story we're about to read ought to sound eerily familiar to you. Okay? But this time, it's not a foreign nation doing this. Now it's God's people, which tells you how far they have fallen. How far they've gotten away from God. How horrible this place is. And I think sometimes we pass by this, and you, I don't know if you remember, in I think it's Revelation where John actually calls Jerusalem Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
And people say, well, that's a little bit much to say that these are God's people, they wouldn't do that, but they did. They did get to that place. And now you read Romans chapter 1, I think, hopefully in a different way, because what Romans chapter 1 says, it says this. Some people want to say, well, Romans chapter 1 is a condemnation of homosexuality. Well, then you misread Romans chapter 1. Here's what it says. It says, because they did not believe in God, because they worshiped the creation rather than the Creator, then God gave them over to a reprobate heart. And with that reprobate heart, they did that which was unnatural. Okay? That's a universal truth. Paul sets it out there in Romans chapter 1 for us. Okay? But it's the exact same thing that's happened here. They've taken their eyes off of God. They've gone after false gods. They've begun to worship creation and the things of the world rather than God. And they have been given over to a reprobate heart to do things that they would, you know, that any semi-decent person would never do. So what do? Look what it says, verse 22. It says, now as they were enjoying themselves, that's the people in the house, the traveler, the Levite and the traveler, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men. Okay, anybody have another word for perverted?
Wicked.
Okay.
Worthless fellows.
Worthless fellows. Again, my comment says here, call them sons of Belial. Perverted men, sons of Belial. Okay, sons of the devil. Okay. Perverted men surrounded the house and beat on the door. And they spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the men who came into your house that we may know them carnally. That we may know him carnally. Okay? So, this sounds just like Lot. Sounds like the exact same story. But I wonder how many people knew this story was here. Now, I think most people know what happened to the concubine and what they did. But how many people actually, how many of you remember actually the reason why the concubine was set out and what the men of the city wanted to do? Okay? This is an indicator of how far they have fallen away from God. They are consumed with their own lust, and not just their own lust, but their perverted lust, to the place that they cannot be satisfied. Okay, except for, and by the way, I'm going to say they can't be satisfied. Even if the man was handed over to them and they did what they wanted to do with him, they wouldn't have been satisfied. Because that type of perversion, that type of being consumed with your own depravity, it can never be satisfied. It can never be satisfied. And I'm going to tell you, this is probably not the first night they've ever done something like this. Not the first stranger that's come into town that's had to deal with this. Questions or comments?
Anybody read the Arizona Republic today? There's a blip in the Arizona Republic today, and I think it's the second page, something like that, one of these headlines. They arrested a man today because on the internet he was soliciting other owners of pet dogs to have sex with them. Today's Arizona Republic. So you tell me what's changed. To have sex with dogs, and they ran a sting on them, and they caught him and arrested him.
That happened a couple years ago here, too.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, it was in a paper a couple years ago.
Bestiality.
Yeah, these are all,
you know. Yeah, it's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Yeah, let's read on. I said, do you understand how corrupt your mind has to get to that place? And by the way, we moved to, as a society, where we have... we've grown to condone the actions that God has condemned.
That's right.
And we moved to that place where anything goes. There is a group called NAMBLA, National Organization of Man Boy Love Association, something like that. Why isn't it shut down? Why isn't that place raided? How does it exist? How can you go on the internet and find anything you want on there? See, we're at that time. We're at that time. And you'll have people defending these guys and stuff saying, well, whatever he wants to do on his own, no one should say anything about. So verse 23 said, but the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. And then he does a lot what Lot does. Look, here is my virgin daughter and this man's concubine. Let me bring them out now, humble them, and do with them as you please, but to this man do not do such a vile thing. You know, where I'm at, my head can't wrap around this. Even what this guy said. You know, I'll just be honest with you. I throw the guy out before I threw my daughter out there to him, but different time.
They're just property. They're just chattel.
Yeah, it is a different time. You're right. It's a whole different time. So, verse 25. But the men would not heed him. They don't want this. Okay. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them, and they knew her. Which means they raped her, and they abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell at the door of the man's house where his master was till it was light. When her master rose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was a concubine. So he pretty much...
Yeah.
Here you go, I'm going to bed. Type thing. Okay? Falling at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up and let us be going.
Sorry.
A lot of compassion there.
How was your night last night?
Terrible. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and dismembered her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. If that does not wake up a people, nothing can wake up a people. Okay. Now the question is, before we move on, which deed are we talking about? The rape that took place?
That's right.
Or the dismemberment? The cutting her up and sending her body parts to the 12 regions of the 12 tribes? We're going to start there next week. Wonderful story. Encouraging story. But again, the reality, and I think we need to realize this. Why is it so important that we share the gospel message with people? Because without the gospel message, they have no hope. And And it does make a difference if people are godly. It does make a difference if people have the Lord. It does make a difference in society, and it does make it. It'll make a difference to for you, for your kids, for your grandkids, for your great grandkids. If we neglect to follow the Lord and we neglect to share that gospel and stuff, the consequences are far-reaching. Okay. All right, we'll stop there. Let's pray. Father, we're grateful for your love and your mercy, and we thank you for the grace you pour out in our lives. And Father, as we've read this chapter tonight and we see this horrible occurrence, and it crosses our mind, how can people get to that place? And yet we have to realize, Father, that you're speaking to us that without you, mankind has no hope. And mankind can do all kinds of things that we could not, on this side of it, conceive possible. Yet it does happen every day in different regions of the world and even in our own country. So Lord, I pray that you would continue to speak to our hearts. Help us see the urgency of the hour that you placed us here, and help us see that you placed us here for a purpose. Let us be your church and your people. In Jesus' name, amen.